So he did things that were actually not good, but the good of it is because the objective. No, that's not what we mean. He spoke openly, harshly, provocatively against the government, knowing that he's going to be imprisoned, with this goal in mind, that that type of language strengthens the movement. That type of language gives courage to the followers. That type of language gives that extra incentive to the followers.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Tehran has organized the fourth edition of its International Conference on American Human Rights. The conference was attended by Iranian officials, experts, and the youth from over 50 countries. The event was held on the occasion of the American Human Rights Week in Iran. It reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Qari Babadi, said the U.S. is in no position to talk about human rights, given its widespread violations.
One can confidently claim that there is no nation in today's world that has not tasted the bitter taste of the American version of human rights. The U.S. administration should be held responsible to the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation.
Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize the issue, and this is exactly what the U.S. has done. A senior Iranian diplomat says human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for the expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism.
Today, human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism. Sanctions and terrorism are the main pillars of the American version of human rights. If they are robbed of these two pillars, they may not be able to continue their dominance and plots.
Analysts believe that the unilateral U.S. sanctions are a means of collective punishment of all people, without any exception.
Here in Iran, people believe that the title American Human Rights Week seeks to condemn Washington's double standard policies with regard to human rights and reveal this very reality to the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Protesters blocking lanes and taking part in slowdowns on busy roads across the UK.
Give us our country back!
Organized on social media by Fuel Price Stand Against Tax, they're demanding deeper cuts in fuel duty. Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced a 5 pence cut in March, but that has not meant much at the forecourts.
Fuel prices in the UK have hit record highs since the beginning of the year. Only a few months ago, it would have cost roughly $90 to fill up, let's say, a 50-litre tank. But now it'll cost $30 more to fill up that same tank.
And that has put the squeeze on the finances of people. Some have had to quit their jobs because they couldn't afford the commute anymore. Businesses, too, are feeling the pinch at the pump and are passing the extra costs onto the consumers, worsening the cost of living crisis.
Worst of all, the poorest are suffering the most. You can't just switch off your power. You can't switch off your car. You can't switch off your central heating. And when winter comes, people will freeze. All of that, a direct consequence of this government's failure to have a joined-up energy policy. And we are literally paying the consequences.
Among the biggest factors contributing to the fuel price hikes, the UK's green energy policy and Western sanctions on Russian energy exports in the wake of the Ukraine war. Sanctions that the UK government was among the first to impose.
The sanctions imposed upon Russia for political reasons have clearly pushed up the energy costs. But secondly, and even more importantly, Britain has an idiotic environmental policy where they import the very fossil fuels that they depend on, even though under our feet there are £1 trillion worth of gas, and in the North Sea there are billions of pounds worth of oil.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has hinted at a rise in UK oil and gas output, but critics say it would have little effect on consumer bills. And as long as the UK, along with its Western allies, fans the flames of the war in Ukraine, scenes like this may well become more frequent. Saeed Purizab, London.
Thousands of Iranian pilgrims have arrived in the holy city of Mecca for the Hajj pilgrimage. This once-in-a-lifetime journey requires spiritual as well as physical preparation. It's an arduous trip, and pilgrims usually start exercising prior to traveling to Mecca to enhance their fitness levels. However, what if pilgrims got sick or had an injury? To make sure Iranian pilgrims will receive proper and quick medical services during their Hajj pilgrimage, the Islamic Republic's Red Crescent Society has taken special measures. First, all Iranian pilgrims have checkups in the country to make sure they are healthy and in good physical condition. After receiving medical approval to travel to Saudi Arabia, each Hajj caravan is accompanied by a doctor.
Our goal is to bring back all Iranian pilgrims to our country in perfect health. We assure our pilgrims that during their journey, a medical team accompanies them, and in case of any problems, they will receive the required services.
Doctors accompany pilgrims in their hotels and provide outpatient services for them.
Three medical clinics operate 24/7. In addition, a well-equipped hospital in the city of Mecca is currently providing specialized services to Iranian pilgrims.
While so far there have been no cases of serious illnesses or injuries, Iranian doctors ask pilgrims to look after their health.
Older persons or those with underlying diseases should avoid going out in the hottest part of the day, and rather go out at times when outdoor air temperatures are cooler.
Pilgrims should also be cautious about getting infectious diseases and wear masks in gatherings and crowded places. Iran's medical team sent to Saudi Arabia has carried the title of the best team for several years, and the key to their success is the devotion and love of the medical staff.
God has blessed us with the opportunity to be here with a group of our friends. We enjoy the spiritual environment of Hajj and serve the pilgrims of Kaaba.
Serving the pilgrims of Kaaba is one of the biggest blessings that has been bestowed upon me in my life. It has been one of my biggest dreams. I hope to be a good servant for Hajj pilgrims.
Providing different services for Iranian Hajj pilgrims is not only a duty, but rather an honor. Mahdi Abbasian, Mecca.
Highlighting the United States' rights violations at the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which the Islamic Republic calls the Den of Espionage. Every year in late June and early July, Iranian activists get together to commemorate the American Human Rights Week to recount instances of U.S. rights abuses in Iran.
United States, who is, you know, shouting the human right. We think that this is just, you know, slogan without any background. And because when it's go to the Iranian people, we have seen that these people have been targeted, and we do not receive any apology about that.
The week-long occasion marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Rights activists say in all of those instances, the footprints of the U.S. can be traced. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board the doomed plane. More than three decades on, and Iran is still waiting for an apology from Washington. Rights activists believe the U.S. has not abandoned its double standards regarding human rights.
We know that more than 30 countries have received the negative sanctions from the United States. Sanction is something that violates the human rights, the right of the development, right of the education, right of the health.
The American Human Rights Week also marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast. The Islamic Republic says the MKO is responsible for killing 12,000 Iranians in different terror attacks. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been taking part in the terror group's annual summits in Paris.
They have withdrawn the MKO from the blacklist, and this withdrawal paved the way for the Americans, not only for the Americans, but also for the MKO, to extend their own terrorist operations through the facilities that they are provided from the Americans and also from the European territories.
The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls on the same period in the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Activists here say Washington has shrugged off its crimes in Iran, and that's why they observe the American Human Rights Week every year to take a jab at the U.S. for its selective approach toward human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alina Lip, a German journalist who has been reporting from the pro-Russian Donbass region of Ukraine for over 6 months. She recently received charges from the German legal system threatening her with 3 years in jail.
On 24th of February, I shared on my Telegram channel the news that Ukraine is killing civilians already for 8 years. And I also said that this is a genocide and that people here in Donbass support the special operation of Russia. And this is a criminal act for Germany.
But Ukraine has been killing civilians here for 8 years. That's just, I think, controversial.
That's a fact. I'm filming here for half a year now, and I'm living in Donetsk, and I'm hearing all the day this shelling around me, and this is not Russia.
And the other one, it says there is that you said that most people here support the separatists. That's a fact as well.
Of course.
A few days after Alina's charge sheet was issued, the main German TV channel ARD ran a story reporting that the Russian army was bombing Donetsk, but then it was the Ukrainian army. The next day, the channel published a retraction and apology. It's not clear how many people who saw the report also saw the retraction.
The courts have also taken €1,600 out of Alina's bank account, money given to her by members of the public who are appreciative of her work. They also say that she is not allowed to defend herself at a hearing. Now, I've read the document, and the only conclusion I can draw from it is that either the German courts are trying to prosecute honest journalists, or that, frankly, they don't have even the most basic grasp of international politics. I'm not sure which one is more damaging to the credibility of the German legal system.
They just want to put me in prison for 3 years, but not hear me out. I mean, what... It's unbelievable. That's And especially they opened this case because I'm sharing my opinion. So there's no free speech anymore in Germany.
Luis Cervera, an independent Spanish-Russian journalist who has been reporting on the suffering of the Donbass people at the hands of the Ukrainian army.
At first, I received a lot of like hate comments, hate in general. Then I received also harassment and different people like pursued me. They published my phone number, all my private information. They even published an address of a flat where I used to live.
While Julian Assange faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in jail, he is not the only journalist under threat of imprisonment for telling the truth. Alina, like many other independent journalists, have been deplatformed from some social media outlets and has had her PayPal account suspended. Anti-war sites Consortium News and Mint Press have also had their PayPal accounts suspended in an attempt to cut off funding.
The job of a journalist is to uncover stories so that society can debate and implement policy based on their findings. Now, while mainstream outlets don't even send reporters to this part of Ukraine, the few Western reporters who are here risk their lives and their reputations to uncover important truths. For that, they risk being deplatformed, smeared, or sent to jail simply for doing their job. There's increasingly a worrying campaign by tech companies, governments, and courts to strangle anti-war dissent in the West. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The recent decision by Moscow to cut its gas supply to Rome by 15%, which was announced by fuel giant Eni earlier this week, did not catch the Mario Draghi's government off guard, albeit consumer confidence in Italy is at its lowest level in over 20 years. On Saturday, Italy's ecological transition minister Roberto Cingolani said he remains confident that filling underground gas storage to 90% by winter, a requirement recently adopted by the Council of the European Union to strengthen the bloc's energy security, is still a feasible target. However, Minister Cingolani argued he expects prices to further surge, particularly after a temporary closure of the Nord Stream pipeline for maintenance.
We're definitely concerned over our gas supplies. Having said that, underground gas storage on our territory has been filled to almost 60%. So, let me tell you, we are doing fine in that respect.
Italy is trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for 40% of total gas imports. That's while prices in the country were 8% higher in June than a year earlier, marking the highest one-month increase in prices since 1986. The energy crisis has been compounded by an unprecedented drought that is sweeping through Italy's northern and central regions. Experts have warned the drought will reduce the country's hydropower output by 60% by the end of this year.
The problems are multiple, and we will not only face the energy crunch and the water shortage, but also the financial turmoil that will inevitably hit the international markets. Let's sit tight, because a financial shock is on the way, and it will start from the US as usual.
Lately, Prime Minister Draghi has been facing problems protecting the government coalition that supports him. A rift has opened up with former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Also, former Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini has reportedly taken up arms against the executive. A government collapse at this very stage could have grave repercussions for Italy's social stability. Max Civili, Rome.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. They discussed cooperation relations, in which Assad described ties between both states as an alliance of will in the face of Western hegemony. During the meeting, the Syrian president touched upon the threats of Turkey to launch a new offensive in Syria. Assad said Turkish pretexts for an aggression on Syria are false, misleading, and disconnected from reality, stressing that they violate the UN Charter and international law. Amir Abdullahian said Assad's recent visit to Tehran constituted a turning point in Syrian-Iranian relations. He added that Israeli attacks on Syria are part of the terrorist war on the country. The top Iranian official noted that Iran is ready to help settle misunderstandings between Damascus and Ankara.
Any foreign intervention in Syria complicates the situation. We understand Turkish concerns over border issues. The solution lies in dialogue between Syrian and Turkish security officials. I understand from my talks with the Turks that they prioritize a political solution.
Amir Abdullahian also had a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. He expressed optimism over solving the Turkish-Syrian conflict peacefully, asserting Iran will exert all efforts to prevent any conflict in Syria. Maqdad welcomed Iran's efforts.
Any solution that leads to Turkey's retreat from Syrian territories, stopping its attacks on the country, and ending Turkey's support to terrorist groups is welcomed. We trust the Islamic Republic of Iran, but not the other side.
Maqdad reiterated Syria's determination to eliminate terrorism and thanked Iran for its support. He stressed that Israel must realize that Syria will not remain silent over Israeli aggressions.
The visit shows the depth of ties between the two allies and the crucial role Iran plays in the region, as it comes hours after an Israeli attack on Syria and amid speculations that Turkey is going to launch a military operation in the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The town of Alamskia. 8 years of war have left their mark. The streets are eerily deserted as the front line is close. The cultural center was hit a few days ago. It now serves as a town hall. From inside, I am pointed out a Russian monument. While I'm filming, the boom of outgoing artillery. Two people were killed at the monument this week. The building, like the streets outside, feels like a ghost town. But inside, I find Elena, the head of the council administration.
People run quickly to the shops, buy what they need, and run home. People are simply afraid of going out. I can't say how people live in the west of Ukraine, but this is how we live here. We hope for peace soon, so we can start to rebuild the town.
The school has been hit many times, as is the market and the hospital.
Now, while elsewhere in Ukraine, it's very easy to level the accusations that Ukraine is shelling civilians and civilian areas, here in this town, it's a little bit harder to do so because, frankly, the front line is only around 50 meters or 100 meters around this town, and there's the almost constant sound of outgoing artillery as well. So Ukrainians may well just be trying to hit these artillery pieces rather than just aiming at civilians.
Incredibly, in this desolate place, some civilians still live here, although most cower inside.
So what is it like to live here?
It's bad. My nerves are shredded and it's always tense. What kind of a state is Ukraine that kills its own people, sending brother against brother? We are hoping soon for victory.
In the adjacent city of Golovka, I meet the well-known mayor, Ivan Prokhodko. He uses a Ukrainian flag as the doormat to his office.
This flag lying over there symbolizes the criminal state of Ukraine, not its people. The flag is my personal trophy as well. I took it at the front line. I was born in Donetsk and I loved Ukraine. But those who took power in 2014 in the coup trampled over democracy and they do not care about the citizens of the East.
Who do you blame for the breakup of Ukraine?
The answer is obvious. NATO countries are to blame, in particular the United States. They needed Ukraine as a hotbed of tension at the border with Russia. You see, I'm for democracy. In 2014, they should have asked what people wanted. But nobody was interested in people's opinion. That's why we have got what we have now. We have a terrible war, dead Ukrainians, dead Russians. It's really horrible. And those who draw benefit from it are sitting across the ocean.
While Russia calls this war a special military operation, Ukraine calls it an invasion. But here in Donbass, the pro-Russian civilians call it a liberation operation. With the Russian army making gains not far to the north of these desperate streets, the 8 years of war in this town might finally be set to end. Jenny Milovka.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
BlackRock is one of the world's biggest corporate drivers of climate chaos and ecocide. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Yusra Bitar and Ali Shah, writers. This article is published under the heading War Profiteering, Ecocide and Policing, BlackRock Vies for Corporate Hall of Shame. Stay tuned for more. BlackRock, the world's biggest asset management firm, has been nominated for the 2022 Corporate Hall of Shame at Corporate Accountability. BlackRock has nearly $10 trillion in assets under management. That's more than the GDP of every country in the world except for the United States and China. BlackRock is a top shareholder across a wide range of global industries that include oil and gas, technology, retail, big banks, healthcare, weapons manufacturing, and much more. And this makes BlackRock one of the most powerful corporate actors on the planet, whose influence touches every aspect of daily lives. BlackRock's founder, chairman, and CEO Larry Fink has attempted to brand the firm as sensitive to global challenges like climate change, structural racism, and public health. However, BlackRock's investment activity and governance practices drive business operations that directly harm Black and Indigenous communities and people of color around the world. The firm props up the fossil fuel industry to the tune of $260 billion in investments in corporations that are propelling climate catastrophe. It has nearly $6 billion invested in civilian gun manufacturers and retailers and an astounding $36 billion invested in military's weapons companies. Larry Fink has been a major donor to the New York City Police Foundation, which supplies equipment and surveillance technology to New York Police Department that has targeted Black and brown communities in New York for decades. For all these reasons and more, BlackRock has been nominated to join Corporate Accountability's Corporate Hall of Shame, and we believe it is an extremely strong candidate for entry. BlackRock is one of the world's biggest corporate drivers of climate chaos and ecocide. Not only is it a major culprit behind the global climate breakdown because of its huge fossil fuel investments, but its wishy-washy climate promises and support for false climate solutions fail to address the root causes of the climate crisis. To start, BlackRock oversees one of the world's biggest fossil fuel portfolios. It is a top owner of the world's most powerful and most polluting oil and gas corporations, from ExxonMobil to Chevron and from ConocoPhillips to Marathon Petroleum. It recently led a consortium of investors that plowed $15.5 billion into Aramco, Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil and gas company and one of the world's dirtiest fossil fuel companies. BlackRock also remains one of the world's biggest investors in the coal industry. While insurance and investment for the coal industry is shrinking, BlackRock has recently plunged more than $34 billion into companies developing new coal assets. BlackRock remains the single largest institutional investor in coal, with around $109 billion invested in the industry. This includes the $1.2 billion BlackRock invested in Adani Group's dirty coal mine project in Australia, which over 100 companies have ruled out investing in due to public pressure. Not BlackRock, though. Simply put, there are few corporate actors that are more heavily invested and have more of an ownership share in fossil fuels and extractive industries like BlackRock. This also means that BlackRock has more power than almost anyone when it comes to holding these industries to account for the damage they cause. But does BlackRock use this power for good? Not even close. While BlackRock is financing the fossil fuel industry whose operations are harming frontline communities around the world, CEO Larry Fink has also been supporting the police as they target protesters and BIPOC communities in BlackRock's home city of New York. Larry Fink served as the co-chair of New York City Police Foundation's annual gala for 4 years beginning in 2016, and he was honored by the foundation in 2015. Fink has also donated to the NYC Police Foundation, which has given millions to the New York Police Department, NYPD, for more surveillance equipment, mounted police horses, and policing gear. In 2020, the NYPD used excessive force to crack down on racial justice protesters after George Floyd was murdered by police in Minneapolis. In fact, the state of New York filed a lawsuit against the NYPD over their handling of the protest. In 2020, of course, the suit claims that the New York City Police Department exhibited a pattern of using excessive force and making false arrests against New Yorkers during peaceful protests. BlackRock's support of police power in the United States extends far beyond just as New York City. As Code Pink has reported, BlackRock is the largest shareholder in Axon, a nationwide supplier of tasers, body cameras, and surveillance software to police departments around the U.S. BlackRock holds 10.4% of Axon's stock, which currently amounts to over $600 million invested in the company. In addition to being the largest shareholder, former chief investment officer at BlackRock, Matthew McBrady, has served on the board of Axon since 2016. Axon has contracts with the police departments in most major cities in the United States. The company's flagship products are a series of tasers that are sold to civilians, police, and the military.
The company claims that the weapon is a safer alternative than guns for police to use in the field. However, a 2019 Reuters report documented a total of at least 1,081 U.S. deaths following use of tasers in the U.S. since they became widely popular with police departments in early 2000s. Another report from USA Today found that 4 of 5 cases that ended in death that involved tasers began as calls for nonviolent incidents, and 84% were unarmed. In the cases where the race of the victim was reported, the majority were Black or Latino. Nevertheless, the NYPD stockpiled the brand new X26P tasers from Axon in 2020. The Los Angeles Police Department followed suit in 2021 by purchasing 5,260 Taser 7 energy weapons from Axon, making the LAPD the force with the largest energy weapon deployment in the U.S. Since 2018, the company has also entered into agreements to supply hundreds of tasers to major cities including Chicago, San Jose, Tucson, St. Louis, and Pittsburgh. BlackRock has directly benefited from Axon's 220% growth in the last 5 years. BlackRock is also the largest investor in gun manufacturer Smith & Wesson, with an 8.3% stake in the company. Smith & Wesson guns or ammunition are used in the police departments in New York City, Los Angeles, Houston, Detroit, and Chicago. The company also makes assault weapons and restraints marketed and sold to police departments. In addition to profiting off of bloated police budgets, BlackRock also props up many companies whose products are tied to gun violence in the United States and endless war and occupation of places like in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine. BlackRock is a top investor in many gun and weapons manufacturers that sell weapons designed to kill people as efficiently as possible, with consequences that are hard to ignore. BlackRock's investments in weapons manufacturers also equip and profit from war machines across the world that create massive refugee crises. In yet another attempt to distance itself from the harm tied to its business operations, BlackRock just announced a new partnership with the International Rescue Committee, IRC, to help refugees displaced by war in Afghanistan. However, as Code Pink reports, BlackRock maintains sizable investments in some of the largest weapons manufacturers in the world, who are directly profiting from arms sales tied to many of the wars that are creating refugee crises. BlackRock has tens of billions invested in the top military contractors in the United States. It is a top beneficial owner of Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon. BlackRock executives and governors also have interlocking roles with these defense manufacturers. For example, Boeing director Stacey D. Harris is also a director of BlackRock's fixed income mutual funds. BlackRock also owns hundreds of millions of dollars worth of shares in a range of smaller gun and weapons manufacturers. A few examples include Vista Outdoors, which sells ammunition, primers, and powder directly to consumers in addition to law enforcement and the military. BlackRock is a 15.26% owner of Vista, a $307.7 million stake at the time of the most recent filing. Olin Corporation, a manufacturer of ammunition and chemical products that also owns Winchester Ammunition, the largest military. BlackRock owns 10.4% of Olin and $825.8 million stake at the time of the most recent filing. Ammo Inc., which supplies ammunition to the U.S. military and the police and is a leading manufacturer of armor-piercing bullets. BlackRock owns 11.26% of Ammo, a $27.4 million stake at the time of the most recent filing. National Presto Industries, which owns AMTEC, the largest volume producer of 40mm grenade ammunition and fuzzing in the world, along with several other explosives manufacturers. BlackRock owns 12.52% of National Presto, a $67.9 million stake at the time of the most recent filing. BlackRock is also a top owner of major gun and ammunition retailers like Big Five Sporting Goods and Sportsman Warehouse Holdings. As the world's top asset manager, BlackRock is a majority investor in almost every major publicly traded company. It profits from those companies' operations and, as a major shareholder, bears significant responsibility for their governance and the impacts of their operations across the world.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite scholars. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
The personality or the outstanding scholar with whom we are mainly concerned for today's discussion is no one but Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi, mainly known as Ayatollah Muassis, because he is believed to be the founder of the Islamic House of the Holy City of Qom. Before getting to his scholarly life and his, we can say, achievements, let's be a little bit concerned with his early life. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. What information can you give us about his life?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi, as his name is speaking, he was born in one of the villages of Yazd, Ardakan, and after the demise of his father, he moved to Yazd with his mother, started learning Islamic studies, and after a while he moved to Iraq again with his mother. Mm-hmm. In Iraq, he started learning all Islamic studies under the teaching of the grand scholars of Iraq. For a while he stayed in Najaf, and then he moved to Samarra, benefited from the grand asatid, namely Mirza Shirazi, the grand Mirza, actually the one who issued the ban of tobacco or tobacco.
Yes.
Also, he benefited from Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, Sayyid Muhammad Fisharaki Isfahani, and most of the Mirza Hussein Nuri. He got permission of Rivaya from Mirza Hussein Nuri, and also he got permission of Ijtihad from the grand ulama. When we look at his move, we see that for several times he went from Yazd to Iraq. He stayed in Karbala for a while, and then he went to Najaf. From Najaf, he moved to Samarra. And he went back to Iraq, wanted to start one very good seminary school in Iraq, but since he didn't have a good supplier, and he felt that this situation is not good enough to initiate or establish a seminary school, he left Iraq again back to the Iraq. Stayed there, and after the demise of Mirza Shirazi, he went back to Iran, and he didn't go back again to Iraq anymore. Mm-hmm. And it is said that in one of his trips, when he was coming back from the ziyarah of Imam Reza, on his trip, on his way, he stayed in Qom because of the invitation that he had received from the ulama of Qom, that if possible to stay in Qom and organize the Hawza of Qom. So he stayed in Qom with a group of his great students, namely Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah Alay, Sayyid Ahmad Khunsari, Sayyid Muhammad Taghi Khunsari, all of these great ulama were his student at that time that decided to stay with him in Qom in order to establish and found this great seminary school of Qom that nowadays every Shia community here and there is benefiting from the scholars and leaders who has been studied in this school.
That's all right. Sheikh Ziyaniyah, before that, before this establishment of Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi, we did not have any Hawza in the city of Qom or something like that? Or no, he was a kind of reviver, I mean, of this legacy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that Qom, from the beginning of its establishment, was a city that was famous by the name of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. And even about 1,000 years ago, even more than that, at the time of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salatu wasalam, Imam al-Hasan al-Askari alayhi salatu wasalam, we had companions of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam living in the city of Qom. So that the city of Qom is, the city of Qom is accompanied with the name of Islamic seminary during the history. But this name, I mean, the Islamic seminary of Qom has been facing with some, we may say, uprisings and, you know, downs.
Ups and downs, yes.
Yeah, with some ups and downs during its history.
Yes.
And when the Hawza in Najaf al-Ashraf was established by Sheikh al-Tusi, rahmatullah alayh, after that, most of Islamic seminaries went under the shadow of Najaf. Of course, we had famous houses in Hille, in a famous city in Iraq, also in Isfahan, also somehow in Nishabur, but it was a Sunni school of thought, in Qom also, and we may have...
In Jabal Amal in Lebanon.
Jabal Amal in Lebanon.
Yes.
And in the... we had different cities, but Najaf al-Ashraf was the dominant Hawza at that time for a long period of time. And even Sheikh Abdul Karim Hawari Yazdi himself, he studied in Najaf al-Ashraf. But after that, when he moved to Iraq, and you know, when he went to Iraq, there was a seminary over there. Yes. He wanted to promote that Hawza. So also it is important to know that he came back to Iraq. He decided to promote the Hawza of Hawzatul Ilmiya in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And after the demise of Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Yazdi, the grand marja of Shia school of thought, Mirza Muhammad Taghi Shirazi wrote a letter to Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri and asked him to return back to Atabatul Aliyat, I mean to Najaf al-Ashraf or Karbala, to be ready for taking the position of Marja'iyah of Shia, because he was at disposal of this, you know, position. But Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri refused and said that, in response to that letter, he said that my responsibility nowadays is to stay in Iran because Iran is in danger of corruption and is in danger of getting deteriorated from the way of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. So it shows the broad horizon of thought of Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri that at that time even he had this mindset that I should promote the religion in the country of Iran. And when he was invited to Qom, there was a seminary over there because there were some scholars also living.
Okay.
But this seminary was not a famous one, was not a powerful one, was not a seminary in which great scholars, you know, coming and going. No, Qom was at that time famous because of the name of Hazrat Fatima al-Masuma, salamullah alayha, and the scholars used to come to this city to stay for a while to have a ziyarat and then go to Mashhad and then come back again to Qom for ziyarat and then go to Iraq. You know, we didn't have, you know, prominent resident scholars that we may count them as great figures at that time. So Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri came to Qom, and this story is also very important to know that when he was invited by scholars in Qom to migrate to this city and to handle and rule over the Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Especially Ayatollah Bafqi.
Yes,
Qom. That's right.
Because you know Sheikh Mohammad Taghi Bafqi also was in Najaf, and then he himself came back to Qom, and he was amongst the inviters of Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri to Qom. In response to this invitation, Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri came to Qom and went to the shrine of Lady Fatimah al-Masuma Salam Allah alayha and paid a visit and ziyara to this shrine, and then he made istikhara. And you know that Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri was not a person of istikhara. He was not, because some scholars, they may do istikhara more, but Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri was not believing in doing istikhara in many occasions. But at that time, because he was feeling that this occasion and this event is very important, he made istikhara. And this verse was the result of his istikhara, that A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim wa'atuni bi ahlikum ajma'in. And Shaykh understood that Hazrat Fatimatul Ma'asuma salamu alayha has invited him to come to Qom and to take the position of the manager of the Hawzatul Ilmiya of Qom.
And I think this was the most difficult task for his whole life.
Yeah,
but it really was a nice achievement, and he we can say left a rich legacy up to today's world. The holy city of Qom, beside Mashhad and Najaf and Karbala, has one of the most outstanding Islamic houses. And then I think because of his great status among the ulama, many scholars accept his invitation, okay? And the teaching courses starts in the holy city of Qom, in the, I mean, official way and in the formal way, isn't it, Sheikh Matavi?
Yeah, you're right. And something that we have to mention, that when we are talking about founding the Hawza al-Ilmiya of Qom, it doesn't mean necessarily that you have to construct a big building and call them that this is the Hawza of Qom. No, by that time we had this phase here, that is the center of the all small seminary schools of Qom, or all small Hawza are related to Faiziyah.
Okay.
But Faizia has been built during the time of Safavid.
Yes.
So it means almost 4 centuries ago. Okay. But when you're talking about Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Arzi, it's almost about one century ago. Almost it's at the beginning of the this century. I mean 1300s.
Okay.
So what do we mean exactly by founding the Hawza? It means that to organize the system of teaching.
Or to manage,
That's right. To start having a board of teachers, to organize the textbooks, the syllabus, different levels from which students have to start. For example, after the first level, they go for the second and the third. Through all these process, which is nicely organized, they know how to start, how to end, where to go, the system of discussion, or what we call it as a mubahatha, to give order to this system. Okay. So this is the true meaning of founding Hawza al-Ilmiya al-Qom, because by that time, as my brother mentioned, we had many scholars residing in Qom, and also the same time we had students who would benefit from those scholars, but not having a comprehensive system which would cover all of these system under which. So by founder, we exactly mean this, and this is also mentioned in his biography, that he was really caring of the students.
Okay.
And he had this intention to do it on his own to the moment that it was possible. And it is also mentioned that once he was reported that one of the tulab is not feeling well. So that moment, maybe it was one of the exceptions that he was free and he wanted to benefit from this very spiritual action, so he even did not accept the servants or those people who are placed for this work to do it. He said, okay, let me, as a manager of the Hawza, go and provide the medicine and take it to that talibe on my own. So it shows that how he was down-to-earth manager, not to just sticking to the chair and not going and welcoming the talibe, having a nice and very good relationship with the students. He was not that of the actually managers.
You know, in his mindset, I mean managerial mindset, even teaching the foreign languages was among one of his achievements. As we could see, we can say in the life of Ayatollah Hujjat Kuh Kamari, we said that he was one of the deputies of Ayatollah Ali Yazdi, and his school, Amin Hujjatiya School, now it is famous for welcoming the foreign schools, but this is not something new. It had roots, you know, in the life and in the style of the management of the late Ayatollah Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi. That's all right. Okay, anything, Ms. Sheikh Zainab?
Another important point regarding him is that he was really in love of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam, so that he was the reciter of Rawdah of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam when he was young. And he was eager to run Majlis al-Rawdah for Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam instead of, you know, some, you know, passion plays that is in Farsi, it's named Ta'ziyah.
Yes.
And he didn't like the manner of Ta'ziyah, so that he was preferring the Majalis al-Rawdah, and he himself also was involved in reciting Rawdah.
Right.
Another important point of him is the books that he compiled and was the author of them. The most important, which is the Durarul Fawa'id.
Yes.
That also named as Durarul Usul. Durarul that Usul is a too, Usuli
right.
book of him that
yes.
is the course in which he was delivering in
that's
his
right.
Usuli course in Kharij level of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
That's right.
And the students of him,
yes,
there are really important figures like Muhammad Ali Araki, Sayyid Muhammad Reza Golpaygani, Mirza Mahmud Ashtiani, and many others, Imam Khomeini
yes.
Rahmatullah Alayhi, these great, you know, scholars of the galaxy of Shia school of thought in contemporary age are all the students of late Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri Rahmatullah Alayhi.
Really a true source of benefit for the Islamic studies, which is even nowadays active, you know, and these new generations are really indebted to the achievements and the efforts of the people like Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi, may Allah bless his soul. About his demise, it is documented that it was Zilqa'dah 17th, you know, in the year 1355, according to the lunar Hijri calendar. After 15 years of residence in the city of Qom, he passed away. Ayatollah Sayyid Sadiq Qumi did the burial prayer, and he was buried in the holy shrine of Lady Fatima al-Masima in vicinity of the tomb of Lady Fatima al-Masima, which is nowadays the burial places for so many of the great ulama and maraja, with the high, we can say, marble stone, we can say, grave stones over there, really the visiting place. And so many people pay homage and visit to these tombs nowadays too, in the holy shrine of Lady Fatima al-Masima in the city of Qom. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziania and Sheikh Mahdavi, for your nice elaboration regarding the life of Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi, mainly known as Ayatollah Mu'assis, the founder or the establisher of the Islamic Hausa of the holy city of Qom. May Allah bless his soul. Thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this program and to download for free our previous programs, I mean The Teacher, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.